questions about the Bracero program.
Yes.
And if at any time you would like to, you know, pause or go off the record or anything, just, you know, raise your hand and
Please keep me from going off on too wide a track. I've got my mother's gift for gab, and I may get a little long sometimes.
Okay. Are we recording? Okay. I guess I would like to know, what is your connection to the Bracero program?
I grew up in East Central Arkansas, between Hughes and Forest City, south of Interstate 40, which was actually built while I was a child, about 8 miles south of Interstate 40 on Arkansas Highway 50. And my father, uncle, and grandfather owned and operated C.J. Beasley & Sons, which was a farming partnership that farmed roughly 5,000 acres. And they had anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 acres of cotton almost every year. So I was born in 1949. Of course, I wasn't around when the Bracero program began, but when it actually came into East Central Arkansas and the farmers there started using that labor pool, I remember it as a small child up to early teenage years, because I was 14 in 1964, and I think that was probably the last year that we used any of the Braceros. They were basically replaced by mechanical cotton pickers at that point.
When the Braceros came to your farm, what did they do when they first got there? I guess by that, did they come to town, or did they come specifically to your family's farm?
What I remember is they came specifically to our farm, and I had probably missed, you know, really realizing what was going on in the early years of it. But each year there were farm tenant houses that were not on the highway. There were still lots of houses out on the farm that came from the WPA program of the 30s. And there were these shotgun cypress tenant houses that my dad and uncle and granddaddy bought a lot of bunk beds for, and bought cook stoves and heating stoves, that kind of thing. And they would actually come to the farm headquarters and then would be taken on buses. They arrived in buses, which I remember looked more like school buses than anything, and would be taken to these houses where they'd disembark and stay in these houses on the farm for usually a couple of months each year. And so it wasn't the process of going into town and picking anybody out, but what I learned as a young teenager was that we almost had the same group. There would be a few different people each time, but most of the ones that we had the year before would come back to our farm again.
Was that by their choice, or did your family request them?
I think it was more by their choice. I had good parents, good uncle, wonderful grandfather who believed in hard work. I mean, they'd come from nothing, basically. But they saw and knew that these people were good people, and they were amazing workers. It was just unbelievable how much work they could get done, how good they were at just about anything they tried to do. But, I think that they probably came back because, they were treated pretty well. I mean, from their standards, which I didn't go down and visit where they live, but I know that the only thing that I remember that concerned them for a while and was that the water that they had, there was no indoor plumbing in these houses, which on the tenant farm houses back then, the regular labor, there was no indoor plumbing, so that was not different than what full year employees lived in. They had an outhouse, and they had a hand pump out in the yard, and the water in that area, there's a very shallow water table. You only had to go about 15 feet to get to the water, but it was rich in calcium and iron. And they would come every year, and I remember laughing with a couple of them because they my brother, who's a year and a half older than me, and I would go down there because we liked to see them, and they seemed pretty happy most of the time. But we had one or two of them that we knew fairly well, and especially one that came out and Senor, no bueno, no bueno, and agua, and he, it was giving him gas real badly, because that which they got used to, and they'd get over it. I don't think it's quite the same thing as drinking water, maybe in Mexico, where you get amoebic dysentery and you don't get over it. They would get over this, but the adjustment to that iron rich and calcium rich water that was different than theirs disrupted their days and nights to some extent, and but they laughed about it. They thought it was funny, and of course we as teenagers just laughed and thought that was, you know, we could understand what they were saying. And my brother actually was enough older than me that he had already taken the first year of Spanish and as a probably a ninth grader, and of course, what he was taking was the Spanish, the true Spanish from Spain, and with a southern accent, they had sort of a hard time understanding what he was saying, even though he was probably saying the words close to correctly. It was not the colloquial Mexican Spanish, but he could sort of communicate with them. And they always had one person that was with them that could speak fairly good English, and so that was pretty much their representative the whole time that they were there.
Well, the story of the water and the effect of the water on them leads me to a question. When someone did get sick, what would happen? What was their medical care like?
We would take them to the doctor in Hughes.
Okay.
I mean, we even, I don't know if we ever had, that was back in the day when doctors would make house calls. Because I've had them make a house, even up into the early 80s, my friend doctor came out to see me when I was really sick one time. But we would take them, if anybody really got sick and was badly sick, we would make sure that they got to the doctors. And at least once a week, there would be a portion of the group, not necessarily all of them, but a portion of the group, that would go to town, and that was one of the ways, if they weren't really badly sick, and we'd tell them you can go to the doctor if you want to. Also, they would pick up their big, I remember the big sacks of flour that they'd buy, because they were, I think they were cooking tortillas every day, and having a little something with their tortillas, but the tortilla was really the staple. I mean, that was their bread. And they'd go in town and pick all that up, and I'm not really sure how that was accounted for. I called my brother, because he is a year and a half older than me, to ask him what his memory was on that, of whether that was deducted or supplied. We supplied the house in a dormitory style living. It was all men. There were no females in the group. Dormitory, pretty rustic housing, and the butane to heat and to cook with, because it would get pretty cool by the time they would stay. Generally September, maybe very late August, but mostly September and then into October. And so it could get sort of cool at night, especially for them. And we'd furnished, you know, mattresses, blankets, all that kind of thing for them, and the heaters, but they had to have butane or propane that we delivered to tanks that we set next to these houses that were down on a dirt road in the field, about a half mile off the road, really.
And so they did all their own cooking.
They did all their own cooking. They would come out. They were just amazing. They'd come out early in the morning and start picking. And about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, they would go to the house, and they would start cooking their lunch. And they'd have their lunch, and then they would take a siesta. And 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, they would come back out, and they would pick till dark. And they would, you know, have a 3 or 3.5 hour break in the middle of the day, but there was nobody that could pick as much cotton as they would pick individually. Some of them, or almost all of them, could pick 500 pounds a day. Now, that's rough cotton, so that's not really a bale of cotton, but that's because it's got the seed and everything in it. But you had some of them that get up in the 600 to 700 pound range, and we didn't have the very best farm employees that we had might get 500 pounds a day. So they were extremely hard working people. I mean, I thought they were great. And of course, my relationship with them, being the boss's son, and actually liking them, you know, I don't consider that they thought of me as a mascot or anything like that. Maybe they did, but I enjoyed being around them, and I know what they did do, because we would handle all their mails. They would get paid in cash, and they would put their cash in envelopes every week and send it home. And you know, you wouldn't think of doing that today, and I'm assuming most of the cash got there in the U.S. mail. But that's what they did. Now, I don't know how the accounting, of course, if you pay them in cash, I don't guess we were collecting Social Security, and I don't know if the Bracero program even required Social Security, because they're not a U.S. citizen. Probably didn't back then, but it was a cash payment was what we did, and probably everybody else did too.
On the days that they could not work, like during rainy days or bad weather days, what would they do?
Generally be right there, because they came on a bus, mm-hmm. and were dropped off, and they would stay there. Now, we found out later on what they might have been doing some of the times, because a couple of years after the program ended, around one of these houses that was on a pretty sandy field, we started seeing these strange weeds growing that got awful big and just didn't look like anything we'd found, and they were a form of hemp. You know, it was marijuana that they were growing, so I imagine they there's a few of them. I don't know if all of them smoked marijuana or not, but I didn't know anything about marijuana hardly when I was 14 years old. And we didn't recognize it when we found it, because it was sort of spreading a little bit in this area, and it was in a cotton field, and we didn't want this weed out there. You know, it's a shame we didn't go on and grow that and plow the cotton up. But we do know that they brought a little bit of marijuana with them, whether they meant to plant them or whether just seeds fell out and that's what happened. But that's the only way they got to where these houses were located. There wouldn't be anybody else, because they were off of the highway. They, like I say, they were a remainder of the program of 40 acres and a mule. And it just so happened that a lot of those 40 acres and a mule ended up down a dirt road as far as 2 or 3 miles. Now, these weren't. This was about a half a mile off of the road where they usually stayed. So it was, you know, I used to worry about all the people. When I started farming on my own, most of the land that I had was, well, all the land that I farmed individually was rented land, and I would rent the farm and all the tenant houses and barns and everything like that went with it. I paid to have indoor plumbing myself put in all of them so my people could take showers and come on sort of into the 20th century. And my dad and my uncle did that later on too when City Water finally put a line out there that they could get water to the house without having to have a separate well at every house with a pump and softener and all that kind of thing. But I think where they were coming from, the conditions that they were living in were probably as good, if not better, than what they were used to at home. And I assume that. I never heard any of them say anything negative about where they were. And we generally got the same ones back each year that came back because I think they had an opportunity to send money home where at home they had no opportunity at all.
Did you ever have any problems with any of them while they were here?
No.
Or any kind of run-ins or with any kind of...
I don't remember any of them. This system, have you read Painted House?
Yes, sir.
I picked that book up and read it without putting it back down, because I related to it, except it wasn't the hill people coming
right
down, and there were actually a couple of Mexicans in that. What we had was the Bracero coming to us rather than the hill people of Arkansas coming down to this area. And so I pretty much lived in that time and remember things being just basically like that book was. I don't remember any of our people going into town and getting into trouble. And I also remember that one of our best employees, Frank Woodard was his name, was amazed by these people. Now, Frank was an exceptionally hardworking man himself, but he was amazed by them, and he's African American. And he didn't have resentment to them. He was glad to see them out there picking the cotton because he didn't really... That's picking cotton is tough. It is hard on the hands and the knees and the back and every part of your body. That is intensive labor. And so I think really our people on the farm who had other things to do, because we also grew rice and we had soybeans, and so you'd have a cotton harvest going on and a rice harvest going on and trying to work the rice fields and everything. Everybody was fully employed doing what they needed to do that were the regular full-year tenants and U.S. citizens. And the Braceros came in to fill this gap of needing extra people to harvest the cotton, because there was cotton everywhere. You know, the little cotton gins just sprinkled all over the countryside, and we were farming cotton on land that you wouldn't even think about putting cotton on nowadays. And part of the economics of it was that you were growing a crop that wasn't producing. You know, if you got a bale to an acre back then, you had a major, major crop of cotton. And the costs have always been high, and I don't know if they were paid less. I really don't know what pay scale they were on. I was too young to know that, and that's the reason I referred my uncle, who's 93 years old, Mr. Ashworth, who's in his mid-80s, to fill in the blanks on that a little bit. But I never remember any of them getting in any trouble.
Do you know of any other relationships between the African-American labor and the Bracero labor, any tension or in general?
No, back then. I thought they got along fine. In fact, Frank, who, like I said, Frank was not a pushover. If something was bothering him, Frank would say anything. He had grown up. He was named by my father. His name was Franklin Roosevelt Woodard. And my father was the one that his daddy asked him to give him a name for his youngest son, and daddy just said Franklin Roosevelt Woodard because he was born when Roosevelt was in office. He'd also named one of them Winston Churchill Woodard, too. But Frank was probably the main person because what he did was he drove the tractor usually, which was sort of a tedious job. You had all these little bitty cotton trailers back then, wooden ones, four-wheel wagons that would hold maybe a bale or two at the most, and you'd have trains. I mean, literally trains of these things. You'd have a like an 85 horsepower tractor, a 4020, that would have 15 or 20 of these trailers hooked one behind the other that would go to the cotton gin. And that was Frank's job, because holding that trailer steady and knowing how fast you can pull it, that train of these things, because none of those were really that tight. I mean, when they were brand new, they probably were not nearly as good as trailers now. But when it would go down the highway, it'd be like a snake almost, because any kind of little looseness in the running gear would cause one of them to pull back and forth, especially if you went too fast. And that would be exaggerated by every trailer. The farther back you got, the more of a whip you'd get from it. So Frank was with them a lot of the time. In fact, he pretty much learned Spanish down there working with them. And all I can remember is he really liked them. He thought they were great. He was amazed at the amount of work that they could put out. And the only thing I think he ever said was, you know, they could do a lot more if they wouldn't take that break in the middle of the day. And here they were picking more than anybody else. So Frank, of all people, had sort of an idea in the profit motive, let's get a little more production here. I don't ever remember any of them, but again, you know, I was young, so if one or two disappeared, I don't ever remember anybody saying anything about anybody running away.
Or if they used that as an opportunity just to get in the United States.
No, because they did a head count. When they come back to pick them up, they did a head count, and there never was anybody missing. At that stage, I really don't know what their life, whether we were in some kind of opposing season to something they had that they could harvest down there or somewhere else, and I don't know whether they went back to Mexico or whether they followed the harvest somewhere else. I assume that they came straight to us and went straight back, but I don't know that for a fact, because harvest season is a lot earlier in South Texas for cotton than it is here. And they may have actually come up with the harvest season, and we would have been about as far north as they would have come, because like in Painted House, you had hill people and other folks coming to this area, and we were only 75 miles south of here. So I don't really know whether they worked their way up here and worked their way back, or they just came straight to us. When I was talking to my brother the other day, he thought that they really had come straight from Mexico on the bus, and that the bus would then go back and bring another group up for either our farm or some other farm in the general area. But I really don't know. That would be for somebody that's 65, 70, 75, 80, 93. They could answer that question.
Do you know if they went to church or, you know, socialized, went to dances, or, you know, did something other than...
They would go to town. There'd be several of them that would go to town, but I think what they were... and again, this is a kid looking at it. My opinion was that they weren't real interested in going to town. They didn't they didn't have anybody there. There weren't a lot of Mexican Americans here at that time. It was all white or black or Chinese. We have quite a few Chinese Americans around Hughes. And so I don't remember a lot of social activities, and where we were was 9 miles from the closest town. And they weren't going to walk the 9 miles. I think basically they just went to town and got their staples and came back. And they just were pretty much camped out there for 2 months. That's one of the, I guess that's the biggest difference in what happened, you know, in Caraway, Lake City area, that kind of thing, where you had them right there around the town. I remember that Hughes was like that on the weekends, with lots of people in it on weekends, and I probably some of the braceros that were right next to Hughes were in that mix in the weekends. But I, being 14, I wasn't driving to town legally very much. You know, I was going to town every once in a while, but it wasn't legal. So when I went, it was one of these things of go and come right back. So I just really don't know. I don't think they had much of a social life at all.
Okay. And as far as their lunch breaks and their siesta,
mm-hmm.
was that something that they explained up front? That they?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there was no problem about
okay.
it.
Okay, because that's a big cultural difference. I didn't know if that was.
Yeah, it was no problem. I mean, it just amazed us that they would cook from scratch every day. That's the reason they had to start fairly early on it, because they were making fresh tortillas every day, making the masa or dough or whatever you want to call it, and then cooking their tortillas. And then they'd sleep for a little while, and it was more. I remember there were lots of beans, big bags of beans, and big bags of flour, and I don't remember what else they might have had, but they just wouldn't come back out till about 2 or 2:30. And what they were doing was they were resting, and they were just like they were at 6 o'clock in the morning. They were ready to go, and they would just absolutely man for man. Outproduce anybody else that was picking cotton.
And you knew that.
Yeah.
But was there resentment from the other workers?
No, because they didn't want to be out there. It was not a competitive thing.
Okay.
They had other things to do. Now, the other thing was there wasn't a problem where they had displaced anybody. This was not workers coming in to displacing anybody on the farm. We had to have the labor during that harvest season, and that's when we needed that seasonal labor. And that's what the program was designed around. I know, since Brady called me and asked me to do this, I've gone online and read some of the different things, and a lot of them go to the side that people were being abused, and I don't remember it that way, and those people at that point in time, I don't think ever remember it that way either. They wasn't, you know, I could see if your only choice was to be working in a chicken place that smells so bad all the time and doing some things do there, and doing something that absolutely nobody else will do, that it's a, and especially if they're getting less pay, that's the system that exists, and it's sort of tough on the people at the bottom of the pile. These guys, what I remember, again, as a child, looking through it with 14-year-old eyes, was that they were happy. They liked the opportunity that they had, because without it, they made enough, is what my brother told me. He'd been talking to them enough to understand. They made enough to keep their family eating for the rest of the year by working up here for 2 months, because the dollar was worth a lot in Mexico. And that's what they did. They sent the cash back, and so they would get the exchange rate. We weren't paying them in pesos or anything, so they probably got a good exchange rate. Hopefully they did.
Do you remember if they bought anything to take home, any souvenirs?
No, they weren't tourists.
I know in some of the research I did, they would buy sewing machines and take them home. I don't know.
I never saw that. Now, I have seen that in one other part of the world. We went to Hungary right after Hungary was opened up, because we were actually in Austria, and the Hungarians had been held back for so long. And they actually did the same thing in Hungary. Whatever money they made, if they had a family member outside of the country, they would send their money out, so that when finally the wall came down and the fences and door gates were open, they came over and got their money. And we actually saw this on our trip to Budapest. When we were going early in the morning east to Budapest, we met an unending line of cars in the dark coming west, going to Austria. In the afternoon, when we were going back to Austria, we met this unending line of cars coming the other way, and they had washing machines, and they had dryers, and they had furniture and whatever strapped all over and in their cars, because they hadn't been able to buy any of that stuff. But they had saved their money, because there was nothing to spend their money on. And I can see why some people probably, if they were close to town, closer to town, that would more likely have happened, I think, than out where they were. Where are these braceros on our farm were the only two houses that were still livable, and we had to do some fixing on some roofs and stuff to make sure that it didn't rain in on them and all that, and redo windows and pipe in for gas for the cooking and for the gas heaters that were in there. They were a half mile. Highway 149 comes south and hits Highway 50, and Highway 50 runs east and west, but it would run west from there. You were almost a mile off of Highway 50 back down a gumbo road. So when it rained, you didn't go in on that road. It's not like a sand road that you could go in on. This other road going to the house was also a gumbo road, but it was only half a mile. And it was a little bit lighter ground than the other road was, so within a day it was passable again. But those were the houses that we had that were still back, they were a quarter of a mile apart, because one of them was sitting in the front portion of a 40-acre piece of land. And the other one was sitting in, they were WPA houses that were built for these people that had gotten the 40 acres and a mule, and then in the construction project that Roosevelt started in the 30s, they built these houses all over the place. And out there, they were oak and elm and cypress, so they'd never fall down. They were termite wouldn't have a chance trying to work on them. Termites just can't eat that kind of wood, so they were pretty permanent structures. And then eventually what happened to those were moved up on the highway years later, and one of them became, after several different modifications, pretty much the bedrock part of my house, because you didn't have to worry about if a storm came along and blew it hard enough, it might tip over, but it wasn't going to blow apart. It was like it's made out of steel almost. But I was not there on the days that they left. So I would not have seen if they carried anything with them because school would have started. And we probably were in school when I saw them most of the time on weekends. I'd go down to the, I'd either ride back there on a tractor or go down, walk down there sometimes because it was about a mile from my house. I could look across the field and see the two houses over there. And I'd be there on weekends or after school in the afternoon when they were weighing the cotton because I was amazed. I'd go down there and see what these scales said when they bring those bags up there and then see what the total was for Manuel or Pedro or whoever it was. And I knew what most people picked, and I knew how little I could pick because I didn't like chopping cotton, but I had a great allergic reaction, I'd call it, to or phobia of picking cotton. That was awful. Unless that's the only thing you could do. It ruins your hands, it ruins your knees, it ruins your back after a while. Either that or you just get stronger and stronger and stronger. And at 14, I thought athletics was the way to do that, not picking cotton.
Did you, you said earlier that the same group came to your family's farm?
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much.
After the program ended, did you and your family maintain contact with any of the Braceros?
No, there was not as good a person as my mother is. I mean, my mother was just the people person of the world. Everybody was busy. She had five of us, and we didn't use them as domestic labor or anything. Now, of course, if any of them had been in that position to be domestic labor or anything, I'm sure that Mama would have kept in touch with them. But she really wasn't involved in that. She'd go down there and, of course, try to talk to them and smile at them. And they knew, they could tell what kind of person she was just by the smile on her face. But no, I don't think we did. And that wouldn't have been me anyway. None of these guys would have been my age. They were all adults. I mean, they weren't, as far as I know, at least they didn't look like there were any teenagers. I think it's everybody that was pretty much 21 years old or older that came in. I think. I don't know. There might have been some 18-year-olds in there. I don't know if there were any child labor laws that affected them or not. Probably not. But it would be the ones, what they were doing, they were bringing the biggest, strongest, best. And when I say biggest, strongest, most of these people were not very big people. I mean, they were smaller than the average U.S. citizen at that time. But they were just cotton-picking machines. They were just amazing that those little people could do that. And that's why they kept coming. I mean, they, you know, all I remember, the main thing about it that David did remind me of was that they were happy to have the opportunity to come up here, because otherwise, whatever they had to do in Mexico, they had a much harder struggle making ends meet for their family. And so it was, what he and I think is it was about a two-month program that they came up here, like they went away to work for 2 months, and they came back, and that would help them the rest of the year. Not necessarily take care of everything, but it got them in a lot better shape to go through the rest of the year.
Right.
Because I know that they, I don't think they were rounded up under a gun or whip or anything like that and brought up here. I think they had to volunteer for it. And actually, we had some of our people on our farm that would leave in the wintertime and go to Florida and pick oranges. Some of our full-time employees would do that. And, I mean, they were up on these ladders 20 feet high in the air, and every once in a while we'd have one come back with a broken arm or a broken leg from falling off of the ladder. So we had to heal them up during the planting season and all that. And then they'd go back in the late winter, early spring, whenever they were picking oranges, they'd be down there picking oranges. Had other ones that would go to the river and work on laying the mats on the river. Those that were doing that were the ones that ended up leaving the farm before it was all over with, because they could do a lot more somewhere right. else.
Is there anything else you would like to add? Or?
No, I appreciate having the opportunity to share it. I remember it as a positive time, and not one that was abusive. Now, I don't know the pay scale and or any of that. What I know is that everybody else that we had, and there was lots of labor on the farm. There were tenant houses all along the highway, and they were all busy because we weren't all cotton. We were rice, soybeans, wheat, milo, cotton. And so at the same time that the cotton was being picked, the rice was being harvested, and if you had a good year to harvest it, you could also get in and work the land, pull the levees down and work the land for the next year. And if the beans, which usually the beans came off toward the end of the cotton picking season, but you had to have your whole crew doing that because you would try to work the land. This was when we were in major tillage rather than a no-till or low-till situation. And so I actually remember it as quite a positive time. I like big machines, and I thought the cotton picker that came and replaced them was impressive, but I never thought it did as good a job. And I wondered some of the time what happened to them. Now what are they doing? Mm-hmm. They had to go to some other crop, or they just lost out. I don't know what it was.
In that regard, I was talking to some of the people yesterday who said that the Braceros would usually pick the fields cleaner than some of the other workers or even machines. Did you have any recollections of that?
Oh, yeah. That's how they got that 500. They didn't leave anything behind. They were just, I want to say meticulous. I don't know that all of them are necessarily meticulous, but they were just amazing in what they did. And that's why a lot of the farmers wanted it to keep going, but even it, whatever was being paid for that, it became a cost price squeeze again, that's the situation on farm all the time. You look at farmers that are 20,000 acres now, and they may have a nice home, and they may have a nice vehicles and all that kind of stuff, but it's the riskiest business there is out there, and they could lose that. They could be 65 years old and lose everything. There'll be a lot of farmers that go out of business this year, even though you see these perceived high prices. Well, costs now match the price, and it's the same thing back then. When I got into farming, I went to Mississippi State to be an engineer, and I was too social to be an engineer, so I became a business graduate. And when I came back, I decided I wanted to farm. My uncle wanted me to come back. My daddy wanted me to go on and do something else. But I farmed for 16 years. And during that period of time, we were always looking for that golden age of farming that's coming around the bend. And we're going to be able to produce all this. And we don't have to worry about whether we make a crop and everything's going to be rosy. Well, I used to pay 18 cents for diesel fuel and rent on an acre of soybean land was $18, and a pickup truck cost $4,000, and a tractor cost $12,000, and a combine cost, first one I bought cost $18,000, and now a combine's $350,000, and a pickup truck is $50,000, and diesel fuel is way higher than premium gasoline. And fertilizer is not produced in this country anymore, and we have to pay whatever. I mean, it's lucky that we still have the farmers that we do, but there's going to be probably another shakeout this year. And that's just a continuation of a lot of these things that have happened. What I think was thought more of back then was that we were still closer. This came along about the time of World War II, the end of World War II. And what people realized then, because they'd seen what happened to Europe and Japan and other places, is if you lose your food supply, anybody can come in and do anything they want to you. And so our agriculture is still the basis for national defense in this country. And so some of these programs like that weren't done. They get the title now, as people look back on it, of being something that was abusive to make the rich cotton farmer a lot of money. Well, maybe it did, a few of them. I didn't know any of them. I really didn't. I didn't know any really big, you know, cat on a hot tin roof, Burl Ives type guys. Maybe they're all in Mississippi. They weren't in Arkansas. And it was family farms that even then, that was my uncle, my dad, and my granddad in the 60s were farming 5,000 acres. All of them, well, my granddaddy didn't have them. My uncle and my daddy had college degrees, and they grew the farm, try to make a good living. Daddy could have been anything. He could have easily been an MD if he wanted to, but he just didn't want to do that. He wanted to farm, and I guess that was my mistake. I wanted to farm, too. But I quit. I quit after 16 years because I saw that I could probably do something else and take care of my family better without risking everything every year. And so I don't gamble because I spent 16 years farming. That was enough. And so the Bracero program was one of the things that it still exists in a lot of different forms, but now you really do see more people that are mobile that come out of Mexico and either come legally or come illegally and stay. Those guys didn't have any choice back then. The bus brought them up here, and the bus took them back, and they enforced it strongly. I think our country is probably stronger because of the blend that we're getting, and we've always got to have labor, or either we've got to go to mechanical for all these things that nobody else wants to do. But it was a whole different time. There were different white-black relations. On our farm, everybody on that farm liked each other. My grandfather and uncle and daddy were not abusive of anybody, and they had a great deal of respect for them, and they had a great deal of respect for me, and I had a great deal of respect for them. This was prior to a lot of social programs that I think ruined a bunch of people that sought the easy way out. I can get a check for nothing. And whether you're black or white, there's probably more whites that went on Social Security or WIC or whatever there was out there. Whatever they could get, there's, I'm sure, more whites than there are blacks. So I don't think it's a racial issue. I think it's a get-up-and-go laziness issue more than it is race. But to sum up, like I said, I go off on a lot of tangents here. I thought they actually felt good about being here. Later on, as they got close to the end, you could tell that they really wanted to go home and see their families, because I think these were really good people who only came up here because it was a way to better what they had down there. They didn't have any opportunity down there. And this was an opportunity to send some money back. And, of course, they couldn't spend it on anything to speak of unless they did buy a sewing machine or something. And I'm sure there was some of that. I just didn't see that. Because when they packed up and left, they basically came with their duffel bags. I remember they had duffel bags that they had their clothes in. And not a lot of clothes or anything like that. And they stayed in a dormitory, you know. About like being in boot camp for a couple of months, I guess.
If I could just ask you just a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. Again, based on the people that I talked to, there was one gentleman there who said that he worked as part of an association that helped bring these people in. Part of his job was to take up the passports when they came to town and make a record, and that's kind of how they did their accounting system. Do you remember any type of processes like that 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 was used to identify who they were and how much they would be paid? And
vaguely, because again, starting coming in late September, early October, the activities that were done during the day of the week, I missed out on most of that because I was in school. And so, you know, I had just a child's viewpoint of it. And I know I was a fairly sensitive child because I liked people. And I was concerned. You know, I couldn't talk to them much. We didn't understand each other, and I wasn't down there enough, and I hadn't taken Spanish yet. It made me thankful of what we had, with the family that we had, where we were. And, you know, I've grown even more thankful for that as I've aged. But there was a record-keeping system to know who was here and who was leaving the country, too, on the bus. But I didn't get involved in that. I didn't really see that happen.
Okay. And you had mentioned at the first that there was usually one person who could speak English.
Yeah, that would
speak Spanish. Was that a crew leader?
Pretty much. And he would be the ones, the way David remembered it, because, again, a year and a half at that stage makes a big difference, really, in how you see things, because he was, I guess, 16, I was 14 in the last year. And he remembered that they had one man that would pretty much pick who was going to town that week and would make the list, and also when they would go to town, be the one that would go to the merchants and tell them what they needed, and then the other guys would take it out. And I rode with them a couple of times, and that's how I remember that. I may have even driven them. I mean, I was driving to town when I was 10 years old getting ice with a pickup truck that all I could get was first gear, and I just never got in a place where I had to back up because I couldn't.
was this crew leader, was he Mexican or was he?
He was Mexican. Okay. He came with them.
Okay.
He came with them, and he picked alongside them, and he earned his own, too. And he may have gotten some kind of extra pay. I remember later on that you also had the cotton choppers that were coming around, but that was pretty much all African American with a crew leader who would get these groups together and they'd go chop cotton, and he got paid, and then he separated that out among everybody else. And I know that they weren't getting minimum wage from him. He was making the money because he had the bus. And so there's all different kinds of things that went on like that, that our entrepreneurial spirit, you know, get me some folks and go make some money. But what it instilled in me was when I hear disparaging remarks about Mexican Americans. They're bad people in every group. And of course, every one of them that's bad that does anything, there's a huge deal made of it. I watched both Chris Matthews and Bill O'Reilly, and somewhere in between is reality. And I formed an opinion that, in general, the Mexican people that wanted to work were as good, if not better, than anybody at working They had a wonderful work ethic, and that meant a lot to me because that boy, that was drilled into me as a child. I didn't like all the stuff. I actually had to get out of school a couple of times. And it wasn't cool to have to get out of school and go survey levees or anything like that at that time, but I guess in a way maybe it was because you're a big farmer's son. But I didn't like to have to miss school because I had to go work on the farm. But I had to do that some of the times. You know, I was sort of Mexican labor too. I mean, and he didn't have to pay me anything. But
if I could ask you just two more quick questions. Again, one of the gentlemen I talked to said that what some of the braceros would do was they would get two cotton sacks and they would cut a hole in one of them and fasten them together so they'd have a big long sack. Do you remember anything like that?
Well, there were actually two sizes of sacks that we had. We had a really long one and then we had a short one that was for people that couldn't pull the long one. I never saw anybody. I just saw them get the big bags and go out there and start picking. And the hand speed, the dexterity that they had, I'd if you take a young Mexican child and teach him how to play some kind of Wii game or something like that, I think he could beat any American, is all I'd say from what I used to see them do with their hands and their eyes. It really was. It was amazing. The job that they did, how clean the field was, and how much those little, I mean, I was 14 years old, so I was probably about as tall as I am right now because I've shrunk a couple of inches. And none of them were any about this big and pretty slight frame, but they'd drag 100 pounds of cotton around from one end of the field to the other, and just did it, and did it every day till the cotton harvest was over.
Okay. Last question again. I had two people tell me the story about how they would take old tires, and they would cut out sections of the tire, and lay their foot on it, and draw the pattern of their foot, and make sandals. They would cut out the old tire and make sandals. Do you remember any?
I wouldn't doubt that they did, but I also saw them make their knee pads with them when they were picking in short cotton, and they'd be on their knees. They could take an old tire and they'd cut a piece of that and strap it on their knees to make knee pads. I don't remember sandals, but that doesn't mean that, like I said, I was peripheral to the everyday goings on, other than late in the afternoon and going down there and watching them and then seeing what the tallies were for the day, trying to talk with them and being around them some on the weekends and listening to my daddy talk about what had happened during the day, how hard they were working. Thankful that we had the opportunity to have them here, because without them we couldn't have gotten the cotton crop out. And I thought it was a good deal for everybody, but of course my daddy was doing better than they were. I mean, he was buying land and he already had a college degree, and but my daddy also went through some times where he broke back to almost zero, and my grandfather actually had broken back to zero. He started over twice. I mean, started three different times farming because of different farming conditions. And finally, he was able to retire at 65, 66 years old and did okay because he had paid for some land. And so it was just a difference in education level and opportunity of where you were lucky enough to be born as to where you fit on that strata. And my people had, back before Civil War, I think we had a bunch in South Carolina, and I think we lost it in Civil War, and I may have had the forefathers that had slaves. I didn't ever think I did, because all I knew in my family was we were out there working with everybody that may have come here as a slave or their generations later, because there was nobody on the farm that worked any harder than I did when I was a farmer, and I wouldn't ask any of them to do anything I wouldn't do. Now, I might do it one time and then ask them to go do it from that point on, but I just remember it as something that was a good thing for a lot of people, and I don't see the negative to it, other than it could be cast in that light if you really had somebody that wasn't paying them what they should have been paid. And I didn't write the checks. I didn't hand out the cash. I just know it was done by cash on a daily basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.